Please be seated. Earlier this year, former CrossFit champion and four-time fittest man on the earth, Rich Froning, added another notch to his belt when he led his three-man fitness team to place first in Rogue Fitness's 24-hour rowing competition. The competition began at 8.05 a.m. Froning strapped himself down into his Concept 2 rowing machine in his Tennessee gym, and he began the first rotation of rowing. He and his team have worked out a strategy. The men would go throughout the hour, each rowing a shift of 20 minutes, and then take a break. In the remaining 40 minutes, they would stretch, take ice baths, lay out in front of the gym's massive floor fan, and watch a Marvel movie marathon on the big screen TV. For nutrition, Froning indulged in carb loading. He confesses to cramming down sour gummies, donuts, eating lots of cereal, sneaking in a few Chick-fil-A sandwiches, and of course, lots of caffeine. Throughout the workout, his fitness watch calculated about 10,000 calories being burned. There was a check-in at 4 a.m. with the athletes. His crew reported feeling, quote, loopy. Their, quote, grip, shoulders, back, glutes, and legs were gassed. The rowing took every bit of strength and endurance they had left. When the final minute arrived, Froning's team, which came in first, reported the totals from their rowing machine. The digital display displayed for them a total of over 224 miles rowed in 24 hours. That is a sustained rate of nearly 10 miles per hour for 24 hours straight. Of course, when I read that about that challenge, I was immediately reminded of our own Hamilton brothers' great rowing adventure across the Atlantic Ocean earlier this year. Afterward, when I had coffee with Thomas, I asked him, what was the hardest part about rowing all that way? And he's a thoughtful man. Those of you who know him know he thought for a second, and then he replied with that classic Thomas smile, rowing through the night. Rowing through the night was the hardest part. There was just something awful about being on the water rowing blind in the dark. I suspect that the Apostle Peter would have agreed with Thomas in that regard. Church historians tell us that, of course, although this gospel is named after John Mark, whom his history tells us literally penned it or authored it, he used his interviews with and the teachings of Peter as his main source for the source of information for this gospel. Froning used words like loopy and gassed to describe how he felt in the early morning hours. Thomas called it awful. Mark uses an even stronger word in our gospel lesson today. In verse 45, immediately following the feeding of the 5,000, Jesus forced his disciples into the boat, and then he made them go to Bethsaida. He said, head for Bethsaida, but do so without me. He dismissed the multitude then, and he left to go up high on the mountain to pray. Now, don't miss these details. Mark is very specific for us, and he's painting a picture here. Jesus had given a very clear, forceful command to his disciples. The wording is strong here. He commanded his disciples to get into, quote, the boat, and then head out to Bethsaida without him. They were separated. Then he's going away from them. He's going high up to pray, to speak with his Father. Then comes evening, and the boat is now in the middle of the sea, while Jesus himself is by himself on the land. And Jesus looks down from on high over the sea. He sees them there in the middle. It seems sort of supernatural to us to read it, and perhaps it was, but not necessarily. If you flip over to the cross-reference, John's gospel, John tells us this story as well. And he adds the detail that this night came during the Passover season. If you think logically about what that meant, it meant that this took place when there was, or nearly was, a full moon up in the sky. So with the light of the moon reflecting down off of the water from a high vantage point, it would be humanly possible to see out across the sea and to find a lone boat, especially if you were looking for it, out in the middle of the water some distance away. Unlike before, when the disciples had sailed sort of lazily across with the intent of resting, this trip was not pleasant nor restful. Verse 48, Mark tells us, Jesus saw them straining at the oars while they were rowing. The word straining in English hardly captures the word that Mark actually used here. He used the biblical word found a dozen times in the New Testament. Pretty much everywhere else, it is translated as torment. Once it's used to describe childbirth and labor. Torment. It comes from a Greek root that describes what happens when an officer captures an enemy soldier and tortures him to get information out of him. Later this year, we're hoping to start a Sunday school class on the Christian just war principles. And as I've been preparing for that study, I've come across many discussions, some of you have heard these, about the ethics of torture during warfare. For many years, the precedent in the United States law code has considered torturing a prisoner a crime. The Supreme Court of the United States upheld this view, which is based on the Eighth Amendment of the Constitution, you might remember, forbidding the inflicting of a cruel or unusual punishment. Legally, torture is defined as an action specifically intended to inflict severe mental or physical pain or suffering and prolonged harm. And the United States interpretation coincides with international law, which classifies torture of prisoners as a war crime. But of course, all of this is a pretty modern way to describe the phenomenon. Lots of countries even today do not abide by these codes even to this very day in the modern world. And in the ancient world, they simply didn't exist. Torture was a common, if not a favorite tool of certain rulers in the ancient world, especially in warfare. Of course, the cross, when we think of the cross itself is a torture device. The cross is intended more for torture than it is for execution. It's a very poor tool of execution, but designed specifically for the purpose of torture. All these are the images, then, behind Mark's word here for the situation of the disciples. He explains verse 48, they were tortured at the rows. They were tormented. Why? Because the wind was against them. If you've ever rowed against the wind, you know a little bit of how frustrating that can be. Kids, if you ever go out, I know some of you actually this very afternoon are planning to go out on a paddleboard. You probably know more about it than I do, but let me give you my rule of thumb. When you have the chance to decide which direction, pick the direction to go out against the wind. Go out, start against the wind. Why? So that when you're coming back and you're tired, the wind helps you to return back to where you need to be. If you do it the opposite way, if you have to finish the journey as your body is getting tired and you're experiencing that fatigue and soreness and then pain, you start fighting. And as you tire, if you're like I am, you start to take these little breaks. So you row with all your might, and then you take a break. And as you take your break, you know what happens? The wind blows you, and it blows you backward. And you see yourself losing all of the, not really ground, I guess, but all the distance that you just went to such pains to go row. And all that progress is lost when you take your little break, and the wind just blows you right back to where you started. It's very discouraging. This is a common weather feature here in the Sea of Galilee. Even to this day, it's known that in the springtime, certain weather conditions can take place. This that Mark is describing is not a storm per se. We've seen Jesus already exercise his sovereignty and perform a miracle to calm a storm on the Sea of Galilee just earlier in Mark's gospel. But this isn't so much the rain and the wind. Mark's very specific. It's the wind itself, not the waves and so forth, but the wind itself. Maybe similar to what we think of when we talk about certain wind events here, the derecho events and so forth of the modern day. This week I read an Israeli newspaper article about a windstorm that took place in the early morning hours between May 14th and 15th in just in 2022. It cost $50 million of damage to the boardwalks and shops and restaurants along the coast of the Sea of Galilee in modern-day Tiberias. They measured the gusts of the wind that night up to 87 miles per hour. Locals there have a nickname for this wind phenomenon. They call it the Whistler. The Whistler, of course, not hard to imagine why it's got this nickname, because it's not only a wind that you feel, it's a wind that you hear, and you hear it building and building as the storm progresses. Mark says that Jesus saw them out there, and he knew what was going on. But it wasn't until about the fourth watch of the night. The final stretch of the night was divided up into four sections at that time and place. We talked earlier about that fitness contest. There was a check-in at 4 a.m. That's about when we're talking here. And it's then that Jesus comes to them, walking on top of the sea. And he would have passed them by, Mark says. Jesus walking on water. This is an image and a phrase we're very used to hearing in church and even in the broader culture. The phrase to walk on water, it's become a sort of common way of referring to someone who maybe goes a little over and above someone's outstanding performance. That guy walks on water. But when it actually happened, the one time it actually happened in the real world, it was something altogether different. Scriptures of the Old Testament, of course, give us this image at rare points. They portray Yahweh, the Creator God, as the one and the only one who is able to tread upon the sea. And at various times throughout history, Yahweh displayed his glory in history, in the world, to his people, to his prophets at times. And his display of glory is described to us, portrayed in Scripture, as a kind of a heavenly parade. And it was a procession of glory as if to pass one by. The glory is just overwhelming. It's a processional sort of glory. And that's the exact language that's used here. Jesus comes to his disciples in their little boat. And he walks through the storm, the wind, as if to pass them right on by. It was a display of divine power and glory. The disciples are rowing with all their might, making absolutely no forward progress. Jesus, in contrast to them, is strolling along on top of the waves. The wind seems to have absolutely no effect on him. First he's behind them, then he's next to them, and then he's just surpassing them right on by. The pressure, the wind, the air, the natural forces that seem so powerful and torturous to the disciples seems absolutely powerless when it comes to Jesus. In their torment and fatigue, I suppose, you know, they too felt a little loopy at this point in their rowing. It's the fourth watch of the night. What must they have thought when they first saw the image of Jesus approaching them? Remember, there's a full moon. There's this loud wind whipping all around them. In those conditions, Jesus appeared to them, Mark says, as a ghost. At the first blush, they saw him. And like a phantasm. Because that's the only explanation. I mean, there's a figure on top of the waves right here as we are rowing through the windstorm. All of the disciples saw him, it says, and they all had the same reaction. They screamed out loud in terror. But immediately Jesus came to them and spoke, "Take courage. It is me. Do not be afraid." Literally, you know, if you've studied the passage, not just "it is me," but "I am." Don't fear. Jesus climbed up into the boat, and as soon as he did, the wind stopped. When they saw this, Mark says, verse 51, the disciples were beyond amazement and overcome with wonderment because they had hard hearts. They'd not learned the lesson of the loaves. They landed in a place called Gennesaret and anchored there. In a few chapters, they will end up making it to Bethsaida, their original destination. But that morning, instead, they went to Gennesaret. And as they did, the people recognized Jesus, and they began to run from all around, carrying to him the sick, their loved ones, the needy. This healing ministry continued for some time, and Mark tells us anyone who simply touched the hem, the fringe of his robe, was healed. And so ends this famous story, famous chapter, Mark 6, a story many Christians can relate to. The disciples suffered because the wind was against them. You know that feeling? We speak this way in our English language about the prevailing winds turning against us. It's easy to feel this way. It's easy to grow weary when this happens. When you just need to stop and catch your breath and the wind drives you backward, back to where you started. Christians can feel this way in our own personal walk with God and sanctification, their spiritual struggle to gain victory over some besetting, beguiling, stubborn sin. You make progress, and then you have setback. You make progress, and then you have setback. And you think to yourself, is this what the rest of my life is going to be like? We can feel this way as Christians on a larger scale. Our cultural winds whip past us. And for all our dominion talk and our grand plans about how our grandchildren are going to launch the third great awakening, here we are. We're rowing with all our might and seemingly falling behind. We are back beyond where we started. We can't even watch the opening ceremony of the Olympics without having vulgarity and sacrilege slipped in. It's enough to make a Christian person cynical. Many have become just that. It's enough to make a Christian fret and despair. Many have given in to these feelings. It's enough to make us, after a while, as Mark said, inspired by the Holy Spirit, hard of heart. May God grant us from all of these things, but especially that last one. May God keep us in the midst of our trials from hard hearts. This verse is one of the references that the Westminster Confession of Faith uses to describe the way that even Christians can, quote, fall into and for some time continue in grievous sins. It happens, the confession warns, through the temptations of Satan and the world, and the neglect of the means of perseverance. The neglect of the means of our perseverance. It is an odd thing, isn't it? That something inside of all of us tempts us in that direction. It's something I've observed throughout my years as a pastor. It's the strangest thing. But in us, there is this temptation at the moment when we most need the means of our preservation to neglect them. The moments when we are lowest and weakest, we are at the same time tempted to retract ourselves from God, withdraw from real personal Christian fellowship, stay home from church, skip worship. In the moments when we most need the means of grace and preservation, a little voice, a fleshly impulse, draws us away. And if we give in to that temptation, our hearts too begin this process, this hardening process. One final thought. If you've studied this passage before, you may remember throughout history, Christians have understood Mark's very curious and specific language here about the disciples following the command of Jesus to be in the boat. The boat is a picture of the way the disciples enter into the church. It doesn't take much imagination to make that connection, to see it there. The disciples are all here following Jesus' command, and they are suffering for it because they've entered the church, even facing torment. Why? The early Christians perked up when they heard this story. They perked up when they heard the word torture used, because it was more than just an idea that they related to. For them, torture was a very real possibility they might face one day. And why? Why would they face it? Just like the disciples, they may face it for no other reason than that they obeyed the command of Christ. They got into the boat of the church and sailed off into the night against the wind. Where was Jesus in all of this? Where was Jesus when they began to be captured, imprisoned, tortured? Did Jesus even see it? Did Jesus know about it? And if so, did he care? Well, yes, they were separated. But just like this image, Jesus was on high. Jesus was praying to his Father, with his Father, advocating for them, interceding for them, and then seeing them in the timing of the perfection of God, he came to them. Yes, he cared. Fatigue, sorrow, pain, suffering, even torture. Jesus has been all of those places. Jesus has been there. Jesus has gone before us into each one of these things. He knows about fatigue. He knows about sorrow. He knows about pain and suffering, even torture. In the darkest hours, you will find that the sandal prints of Jesus go before you. He's already been there. And in the perfection of his timing, by his Spirit, he comes to be present with his people, wherever they are, as he was in the beginning, as he is now, and he will always be. He is a very present help for his people in our afflictions. One of my old pastors used to say, in the midst of trials, there are three truths to cling to, simple truths. God is in this. God is up to something. God is up to something good. God is in it. God is up to something. God is up to something good. Scripture says that God intends even our trials to produce in us good things. Good fruit come from trials. Patience, endurance, perfection. But that can be very hard to see. It's easy to say that in church. It is hard to live that when you're at the oars and it's the fourth watch of the night and the wind is not relenting. Trials and afflictions have a way of producing in us something else. We have a word for it in English: discouragement. Discouragement. It's interesting, isn't it? Precisely the thing Jesus called his disciples to during their torment. Courage. I am here. Take courage. if we're not careful, it can produce the opposite, discouragement. There's a beautiful old hymn about this. We've been learning it on Sunday evenings together. It says, God moves in a mysterious way his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. You fearful saints, fresh courage take. The clouds you so much dread are big with mercy and shall break in blessings on your head. Judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trust him for his grace. You know that line, many of you. Behind a frowning providence, he hides a smiling face. Throughout this chapter, we have seen the difference between Jesus' heart and the disciples' hearts. Jesus' heart is different. The disciples are weary. The disciples are irritated and fed up with the needs of the crowd. They want to scatter the sheep. The disciples here are filled with fear and hard-hearted. On the other hand, Jesus is full of compassion. So the apostle would tell the Ephesians that he prayed on his knees for them that they might know the love of Christ, which is, he says, truly unknowable, unfathomable. But this, in our epistle reading, this is what he said he prayed, that they might know something of the love of Christ, which passes knowledge. I believe this is a big part of what we're supposed to understand about the loaves. This is a big part of what will keep us from being hard-hearted. The love of Christ, the heart of Christ. We'll look at that lesson in a moment at the table, but first, please pray with me. Our gracious Heavenly